What's up, everybody? I'm back with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast, where I've got very special guest Luke Broyles. We go over it all. We go over where Bitcoin's going, where it's been, what's up with nation state adoption, and much, much more for this current cycle. So tune in for another action-packed episode. And as always, ladies and gentlemen, please remember that this is not financial advice. Everything you hear in this podcast is strictly the opinion of Luke and myself and should not be taken as financial advice. All right, quick breath there, but how do you store the hardest money possible? Well, I've got the solution for you to store your seed phrase. That's right, it's Stamp Seed, the number one place to store your seed phrase. They've got titanium steel, titanium punch plates that you need a hammer that they've specially designed just so you can knock that thing in. And you can use promo code GREENCANDLE for 15% off the entire thing. That's right, 15% off. I'm saving you sats so you can store your sats securely and in most secure way possible. So go get you a steel punch plate. And how do I get all my news for this? How do I know what's going on? Well, I check out BitcoinNews.com, the number one place for you to get all your Bitcoin news. And they got an outstanding newsletter. So go ahead and subscribe to that and tune in to BitcoinNews.com, the number one place where you can do that. And I've got merch coming soon, so be on the lookout for that, ladies and gents. Smash that subscribe button and let's tune in. Bing bong. I'm back with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast, where I've got the man, the myth, the legend, Luke Broyles in the house on halving day, nonetheless. So Luke, how we doing today, man?
I'm doing all right. I've had, you know, a lot of ups and downs recently, as is life, but the halving, it's definitely only hit me in the last few hours. Like, holy cow, the halving is today, you know. It's one of those things that, oh yeah, the halving's this year. Oh yeah, the halving's next month. Oh yeah, it's next week. And now I'm like, holy cow, it's like in a couple hours here. So yeah, it's a little exciting. I'm a little excited today. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, awesome stuff, man. Well, let's start it off the bat, man. We have the current price sitting at around 64K. We've gotten an all-time high before the halving, the first time this has ever happened. And yeah, we got ETFs coming. So let's hear it, man. Where do you think we're going from here? Where do you got a price prediction before the end of the year or before the end of this cycle? I'm going to put you on the spot to start off.
I love it. Yeah, you got to appeal to where people are. Most people care about that, right? They want to know where the price is, you know. I think the name of your show, Green Candle, is very fitting. I think we got a lot of green candles ahead. A lot of people are pretty pessimistic right now because Bitcoin has done a red candle, right? We've had a pretty significant red candle, you know, 15, 20%, whatever it is, down. Obviously, it's because of the tragedy of the Israel, Hamas, now maybe Iran conflict. But I mean, if people really zoomed out, and, you know, I mean, we had like 7 or 8 monthly green candles up to this last one. So to be frank, that's way more than I expected. You know, in the bear market of 2022, you know, the bottom of the market, I would not have expected we would hit an all-time high before the halving. You know, I mean, and that was the narrative, right? I bought into the narrative, I suppose. Obviously, I was bullish on Bitcoin when the narrative was anti-Bitcoin. But, you know, the narrative, you know, I think this is worth reminding people, the new people listening, but as well as the people that, like you and me, Brandon, were around, but we just forgot, you know, FTX collapsed and the narrative was Bitcoin's going to take 5-10 years to recover. And here we are barely 18 months later. And not only we've recovered, I would argue, very violently to the upside, despite underwhelming retail interest and despite, I mean, relatively underwhelming major catalyst, right? With the exception of the ETF, obviously. Obviously, that's the exception to that rule. But, you know, the masses are not here. Retail is not here. I personally do not think the Saudis are here. I do not think other countries will be making Bitcoin legal tender anytime soon. I don't think we have another Michael Saylor or two anytime soon. You know, maybe we do this cycle. Maybe we probably have at least one more this cycle. But I mean, all things considered, like, you know, the ETFs are one major bullish catalyst. It's probably one of the top three bullish catalysts. But I mean, I think there's at least a dozen different potential bullish catalysts out there. And it's just most of them are not in full gear. And yet Bitcoin price, nominally at least, has been just done really well the last 18 months. So I don't have a price prediction. I mean, hopefully people that watch my stuff know that I don't really like price predictions within a certain time frame. I'm more than happy to say that Bitcoin's going to $100,000, then $1 million, $10 million, $100 million, $1 billion, $10 billion, $100 billion. I mean, that there is no nominal top for Bitcoin. And, you know, to a lesser degree, there was no purchasing power top either for Bitcoin, right? So both in terms of purchasing power and nominal fiat price, I believe Bitcoin's going up forever. Obviously, Bitcoin on a percentage basis will go up faster in terms of fiat costs. But I mean, you know, it's going up indefinitely in both senses. So, I mean, I don't know. Right now, like you said, Bitcoin's $60,000 or so. I mean, it easily could be $100,000 like at any time. You know, by the end of this year, I mean, that's what, roughly 10 months, 8 months away. I think we could perhaps have a major spike up. I mean, it's entirely possible we have six figures, maybe even by the end of 2024, we could be pushing a $200,000 Bitcoin, or we could be back below 40K again, back below 30K again. I mean, you know, I think it's really a fool's errand to try to predict the price. I mean, you know, you can have all the cute models you want. You know, and some of them I think are more valid than others. I think there's all models are wrong, but some are useful and some are really useful. But I think ultimately, you know, I have no idea what this war in the Middle East is going to do. And I think if anyone watching this has any idea of what they think is going to happen with certainty, enough certainty to place their life savings betting on it, I think that's idiotic. You know, I mean, the war could escalate. You know, I mean, we got to keep in mind, as bullish as we all are in Bitcoin, as much as we all understand Bitcoin is the hedge against political instability, you know, there are 100 nations in the world other than America, right? And, you know, the world tends to forget that, right? Or especially Americans tend to forget that. But, you know, there's 100 other nations in the world. If just half a dozen of those nations were to have their own political currencies collapse, which if you're in Bitcoin, I think we all expect that to happen. I mean, we should expect there will be periods where the dollar outperforms Bitcoin, meaning that Bitcoin crashes in the dollar, right? I mean, you know, all the Bitcoiners like to talk about Argentina and Turkey and Sri Lanka and Nigeria and elsewhere about their currencies collapsing. But the reality is, if we actually had a major currency collapse of a couple of small nations, or one, let's say, G20 nation, or maybe a little smaller than that, I mean, that would have massive fear for people. And most people would resort to the dollars, just a matter of fact. So I think it's going to be increasingly nonsensical to try to trade Bitcoin, because as fiat continues to cannibalize itself and deteriorate, I mean, you know, I think there could be these brief periods where people flock to the dollar instead of Bitcoin because of political instability. I think the war in the Middle East right now is a sign of that. And so in that case, obviously, Bitcoin could go down again. It could go to 50K, 40K, 30K. You know, maybe we see 20K again. I don't know. Like, that would be a significant crash. That would be a, you know, 65-70% crash. I mean, maybe we could see that. And I'm saying that not because I think it'll happen. I think it's a very low probability. But even if that were to happen, I'm still buying more Bitcoin. I wouldn't sell my Bitcoin, you know, just because the price went down, you know, especially probably considering what event depends the event that would be a catalyst for that. But yeah, Bitcoin could easily go down again. But I think far more likely is that it just skyrockets upwards. I mean, you know, if I'm a country, you know, let's say that does happen. Let's say this cycle, and I think this might sound a little absurd to people, but we got to keep the last 4 years in mind, right? I mean, Brandon, if we were having this conversation on the eve of happening in, what was it, May of 2020, I mean, I posted this yesterday, I believe, but, you know, we got to keep in mind what has happened in the last 4 years, right? We had the pandemic. Technically, it started before the halving, but, you know, basically May 2020 onwards was the pandemic. Like, we had the pandemic. We had the largest riots in American history that summer. We had lockdowns. We had the biggest stimulus ever. We had thousands of dollars going out to people who were sitting at home. We shut down the economy. Millions of businesses went under. Tens of millions of people went without jobs. You know, the CDC and WHO both admit that 18 million people died in the last 4 years. Only 6 million or 6.5 million or so are attributed to COVID. So, you know, all in all, there's at least a dozen million people that I would argue needlessly died in the last 4 years from various fiat shenanigans. So I'm not saying that to be a doomer. I'm saying that to say that this halving, we should be an optimist because we're in Bitcoin, we're inherently optimists, but we also should be very aware that what if one nation, just one nation, this upcoming cycle has their currency actually die? Not like Egypt, where it's a 60% devaluation. Not like Nigeria, where it's 10x overnight. Not like Argentina, you know, not like, you know, what you're experiencing in Canada or Australia. Like, not like that. But I mean, like, actually, what if, you know, a major country, you know, like, let's say Turkey or something, you know, a country maybe half the size of Turkey, like, what if they actually had a hyperinflation? I mean, you know, us Bitcoiners, you know, we, you know, maybe that's fear mongering, but I'm really not trying to. I mean, most people watching this probably would agree that all fiats are eventually going to hyperinflate against Bitcoin. It's just a question of time. And so I think that's the question. What if one country in the next 4 years does that? I mean, I think it's entirely possible, again, getting back to the question of price prediction, if that happens, most people would probably be extremely emotional and illogical, and in that emotion and illogic flock to the US dollar. And we could easily see Bitcoin crash in terms of the dollar significantly if people holding Bitcoin assume that the American political currency unit is going to be the safe haven in light of political currency turmoil elsewhere in the world. So we could see that. However, while that's a probability, I think the far higher probability is that, you know, if that were to happen, we see Bitcoin skyrocket, right? You know, if I am the deteriorating nation and, you know, my currency is on its way up, right? Let's say I've got, you know, maybe 10 to 30 million people in my country. You know, let's say I'm a developing nation. So maybe all but a few hundred thousand of them are, you know, very poor. You know, a few hundred thousand maybe are quite rich, and then probably a few hundred people are very, very rich, right? You know, millionaires or multimillionaires or whatever. So, you know, I've got, you know, a decent sized developing nation and my currency is on its way out. You know, maybe I'm one of these countries that in the last 4 or 5 years or so, this last halving cycle, maybe we had an inflation rate in the double digits, entering the triple digits. And now we realize, or I realize as the nation's leader, you know, we're going the way of Venezuela, Zimbabwe, and now we actually have a major currency crisis on our hands, right? You know, what would I do? Maybe my country produces oil. Okay, maybe I start printing more money to produce more oil, you know, as fast as possible so I can, you know, afford everything. Or maybe we mine gold or cobalt or some other metal, that, you know, like many developing nations do. You know, I could do that. But, you know, if I was the leader of a country and I understood Bitcoin and we were at that tipping point, you know, where we were about to start witnessing total lack of faith and trust in our nation's currency. I mean, at that point, it would be almost an epic moment. Flip the table. Let's smash buy to buy Bitcoin, right? Obviously, if I'm the leader of that nation and I don't understand Bitcoin, I'm not going to do that. And obviously, if we're not at that tipping point, it's not yet risk reward in my favor, right? You know, before the tipping point, it's too risky to smash buy Bitcoin with printed money because then you accelerate the very moment that you're trying to protect yourself against. But if you're already on death's door and the Titanic is, you know, a few minutes away from sinking, I mean, if I'm the leader of that country, why would I not just, you know, there's a lifeboat, you know, it's a little too far and it's away from the ship. And it's a little too far down. I might break my leg doing it, but it's like, holy cow, this Titanic's about to go down and the mass of the ship's going to suck me underwater. I'm going to die from hypothermia in 2 minutes. I mean, you know, if I even make it that long. And so, you know, it's like, even if it's incredibly risky, it's the only logical thing to do, jump for that lifeboat. And so I this is a long answer, but I'm saying in all this is that I don't really like saying price prediction by the end of this year, or even this cycle, you know, like I think, you know, the general consensus right now is that we see somewhere between a $200,000 to $400,000 Bitcoin at some point this halving cycle between 2024 and 2028. So, I mean, you know, if you want to have me say that, I think that's probably right. However, consensus is wrong. Everyone, you know, pretty much everyone at the peak of last bull market thought we couldn't crash. Then we crashed. Then when we crashed, everyone thought we can't possibly come back, let alone new all-time high. Then we did, right? You know, there was the 100K Bitcoin by halving crew. Like, okay, they were technically wrong, but they were directionally correct. And everyone that was making fun of the 100K by halving crew, they shouldn't be laughing at those folks for being wrong. They should be astounded that we got 73% of the way there. I mean, it's incredible, you know? And so I guess all that to say is that I really don't know. Maybe we hit only $150,000 Bitcoin this cycle. Maybe we don't even hit $100,000. Maybe we hit $400,000. And if at some point in the next 4 years, there were a singular nation, a relatively small nation, that were to print their own legal tender for Bitcoin. Maybe that doesn't happen. That's not a prediction. I'm just saying, what if? If it happened, the two scenarios are the dollar has a rapid period of demand and Bitcoin crashes, or perhaps the dollar does have a rapid period of demand, but they begin printing their own currency, not only for dollars, but for Bitcoin. And in that case, I mean, pretty much any price prediction would have you say of, oh, Bitcoin ended this year, Bitcoin this cycle. I mean, everything's out the window, right? You know, and again, that doesn't even mean Bitcoin appreciates in real terms. It might just mean it appreciates in nominal terms, right? You know, I mean, it's like we just, you know, we are not ready. I mean, I think we've got a lot of change the next 50 years. And, you know, I think if we're going to try to extrapolate the last 15 years onto future cycles, I mean, I just don't know if that will work, right? So I'm going to be very clear, you know, for everyone watching that, you know, I mean, nobody should yell. I like to position myself very carefully so that in 4 years, nobody's yelling at me that I gave them the expectation or guarantee it was going one price to the other, right? I mean, Bitcoin could easily crash 50, 60, 80, 90% if we have some sort of major catalyst. I do think we're going to have a catalyst. But I think by far, you know, perhaps even by a factor of 10, I think the way more likely scenario is that as countries have their political currencies fall apart, Bitcoin forces up. And I suppose to finish my rant, the reason I say that is that if I'm the captain of the Titanic, if I'm the captain of the ship and the ship's going down, you know, I only have so much control. Okay, my currency's dying. I only have so much time and so much control. I need a guaranteed win now. And so my two options are manipulate my currency, manipulate the market, and hopefully the Bitcoin bros, the crazy Bitcoiners will sell their Bitcoin in a panic, right? You know, maybe I do that, right? Maybe I'm BlackRock, maybe I'm the US government, and I want to scare people into selling their Bitcoin, and I'm going to do it by a big price crash, okay? Maybe I can manipulate the market to do that, right? The problem, though, is number one, that takes a lot of time, and number two, there's no guarantee. There's no guarantee that the Bitcoin holders are going to sell it, right? Especially if I'm smart and understand that the Bitcoin holders have been here through many orders of magnitude upwards of price. Like, they're kind of crazy. They're kind of, you know, as Druckenmiller called us, zealots, right? So they may not even sell, or even if some sell, maybe not enough will sell. So then the other option is that, well, why don't I just print more money and force Bitcoin price up, right? Like the only control I have on the Titanic is the captain of the ship that's sinking. My only control is to stop people from leaving the ship, right? So maybe if I'm having a significant crisis with my currency, maybe the solution for me is not to scare people out of selling their Bitcoin so that I can then grab it up for cheap on the down low off market and then somehow avoid forcing price back up on my own smash buying. But it seems to me that the more logical answer is, oh, well, I'll just shut everybody in the Titanic, keep everyone on the ship, and I will force Bitcoin price up faster than the population can buy, right? And so to me, I think eventually, again, I'm not predicting that this year, I'm not predicting that next cycle. In fact, I'm not predicting any time, but I do think at some point, nation states, even starting with small ones, realize, oh, the way for us to buy more Bitcoin is not to scare Bitcoin holders out of selling it on, you know, a hope, not a guarantee, and, you know, assuming that Bitcoiners act irrationally. You know, I think the better thing to do, the more strategic move to do, is do the thing I actually have control over. I don't have control over the Bitcoiners' emotions. I do have control over the unit of account that the rest of the population is using. So, you know, print, baby, print. Let's accelerate our game of musical chairs. Let's accelerate the hot potato game. Let's kill our own currency as fast as possible. Transition to Bitcoin in the process. And I think that is the risk-adjusted way for a nation to print their own legal tender for Bitcoin. So, you know, I think price prediction this year, I don't know. I mean, we're at 65K. Maybe we hit 100. Maybe we go down under 40. This cycle, maybe $200,000 to $400,000. But at the end of the day, I genuinely don't care, because all it takes is one nation doing that, again, even a small one, to have a massive implication on nominal price. And then if we had three, I mean, that's the thing we can't imagine. Like, if this cycle we had one nation do that, and then next cycle we had three competing with each other to do that, I mean, it's like all bets are off, right? So anyway, yeah, I think my prediction is that Bitcoin's going up indefinitely, in real terms and especially nominal terms.
Yeah, there we go. It's going up forever, lawyer, right? But, you know, I mean, you're talking about nation states and other countries, like, almost necessarily, like, losing faith in their currency. You know, I'd even argue that the spot ETFs, how BlackRock and a lot of traditional finance is just dumping billions and billions of dollars, like, on a daily basis almost, into these spot ETF products, would almost be like a flight for safety against, you know, their own, against the US dollar, right? I mean, I think, you know, I would almost argue that traditional finance is already kind of paving the way for this to happen. And the SEC
you know, did as long as they could to try to like keep pushing that, kicking that can down the road until finally, you know, Gary Gensler allowed 11 of these products to go through. You know, the U.S. was one of the later later countries to let a spot ETF go through. So in my eyes, I'm already kind of seeing that, I guess, distrust from the U.S. dollar within our own country, right? I mean, obviously we saw El Salvador move to a Bitcoin standard, and we'll see other countries kind of start to trickle towards there. But like you said, I'm not quite sure we'll see one that this year go to a Bitcoin standard. I mean, obviously El Salvador is a major success story and others are starting to turn heads. But I think the benefit that El Salvador had is that it's an extremely small country and that Bukele had a lot of rules. So he could flip things on his head and make a ton of changes like he has in the past few years. But, you know, then again, politicians, right? I mean, how can you really trust them? We just saw RFK kind of flip from going to Bitcoin to now kind of shitcoining and shilling all that kind of stuff too. So it's really hard to trust that. But yeah, I mean, I definitely am bullish going forward, exactly like you said, with all these other countries and traditional finance coming in. Do you see it sort of that way as like traditional finance going into these spot ETFs almost as like a hedge against the US dollar? Or do you just think that they're kind of in it for the fiat nominal gains?
Yeah, I think definitely they're in it for the fiat nominal gains. You know, I think Bitcoin is the Trojan horse, you know, of that, right? I mean, you know, most people buying Bitcoin, even most people owning Bitcoin, are pricing it in dollars and using dollars as a unit of account still, right? I just don't see it. I mean, there's been, what would that be? You know, hundreds of billions of, I mean, how much do the ETFs own? Like 50 billion? 40 billion, I don't even know what they own anymore, but tens of billions. Let's say tens of billions of dollars of Bitcoin. I mean, I think probably the vast majority of that capital in Bitcoin is from people that don't understand it, right? I mean, people that I think don't understand Bitcoin is the monetary singularity, or people that are just doing it as a form of diversification. And I just, you know, that's fine. They're smart. They're ahead of 99% of people in the world. But, you know, it's an entirely different worldview than the one that you and I are talking about right now. So yeah, I definitely don't see that at all yet, but that doesn't mean it won't happen. You know, I mean, to your point about El Salvador, I mean, I think El Salvador, and also throw Michael Saylor in there because basically he's his own country. If we're talking market cap, right? You know, pretty much, you know, I think both of them are outliers. Like, we may not see another nation state adopt Bitcoin as legal tender, maybe till 2030. I mean, you know, I don't think even most people in Bitcoin understand that, you know, both Saylor and El Salvador are kind of exceptions. What I would argue is the rule. I mean, you know, if you really understand the history of both of those entities, I mean, they were the right people at the right place at the right time with the right knowledge, with the right, you know, legal framework. You know, I mean, most other countries, you know, in El Salvador's case, or most other people in Saylor's case, just don't have that optionality, even if they had the same desire as them, right? And most people just don't have that desire. So, you know, I think we're extremely early, but that shouldn't, I'm not saying that to be discouraging. I think it's the precise opposite. I think it makes you only more ridiculously optimistic if you realize that, you know, this whole, oh, Bitcoin's going to a million in the next 18 months and then we're going to have hyper-granized world. It's like, no, it's going to take decades longer, but it's not going to a million. It's going to a billion or a trillion, right? So, you know, I think there's a lot of nuance. So yeah, I definitely see it. You know, it's the very beginnings of the beginning of that Trojan horse. But yeah, definitely most people buying the ETF, they have no clue what they're buying, right? In fact, I think owning an ETF is nonsensical, right? It's like jumping off the Titanic, hopping into the lifeboat, and then creating some sort of financial wizardry where the success of the lifeboat is also tied to the success of the Titanic. I mean, it's nonsensical. You want to buy Bitcoin because you don't trust human beings to manage the supply of currency units, and yet you're going to then entrust the very currency outside of human control back within the constraints of human control in the ETF. I mean, people owning Bitcoin in the ETF, or they own all of their Bitcoin in an ETF or on an exchange, I mean, respectfully, and I'm saying this lovingly to them, they're being hypocrites. They just are. They have no right to laugh at Peter Schiff for, you know, dunking on Bitcoin for over a decade. They have no right to laugh at their, you know, quote unquote normie friends for not buying Bitcoin. They have no right. They're being hypocrites to themselves. They don't own Bitcoin. They have zero UTXOs. You know, I'll have people reach out to me asking about UTXO management, but they're all in the ETF. I'm like, dude, your problem's not the UTXOs. You don't own a single UTXO. Do you? You know, and I'm not saying it to be you know, brass or rude to anyone. I'm just saying it because it's true. You know, people that own the ETF, they don't understand what they own. They think that they've gone west, crossed the Mississippi, and gotten their stake of land on the American frontier. But all they've done is they bought a piece of paper that someone east of the Mississippi has sold to them. So, you know, I think the sign that most Bitcoiners think the ETF is acceptable is just a sign of the times of how absurdly early we are, right? I know, you know, for people like you and me, Brandon, you know, we might be in our little bubble where most of us understand, and hopefully the people watching this understand why the ETF is not tolerable counterparty risk. But most people in quote unquote Bitcoin, like as a whole, like globally, most of them think the ETF is fine. So I think, yeah, I definitely think, you know, we're not there yet. I think the ETF in of itself is evidence of that, right? And to be fair, I'm bullish because of the ETF, right? Obviously, people are buying because of it, but you can have nuance, right? You can think that something is good for Bitcoin, but also not think that the people that are owning the ETF are going to end up in a good scenario, right? So it's possible to have nuance there. It's not binary. So yeah, that's my thoughts with that.
Yeah, I mean, 100%, right? I think, like you said, it's another Trojan horse to kind of get into people. And I think it's another touch point, right? I mean, you know, mainstream media, all that kind of stuff is now covering Bitcoin more than I would say they were doing 4 years ago around the halving. They have been just kind of this whole cycle, right? I mean, we get the Peter Schiffs of the world kind of going in there being doomers and telling everybody that, you know, Bitcoin's trash. But, you know, you brought up Saylor and Bukele, and I kind of want to dive into that too, because, you know, like you said, they're both kind of right place, right time, but it's also very rare to have somebody with that strong of conviction about Bitcoin in that position of power. So, I mean, you said, like, basically, you don't think we'll see another Saylor again. And I kind of agree with you. Do you think, I guess, the next billionaire of this cycle will probably come from, I guess, a Bitcoin hodler who just had, or maybe there is one already. I mean, Satoshi technically could be at this point if he actually has the keys. Which I don't know. I'm of the understanding that I don't think he necessarily does, but yeah. Like, do you think another, I guess, billionaire could come in and have that deep of conviction when essentially, you know, they've made their billionaire status in this fiat world, right? So it's kind of, I guess, almost like reverse, seeing things flip on its head, or in a sense, how he's done that. So yeah, how rare do you think that is, and do you think we'll see, like, I guess, another Saylor or even a Bukele or anything like that?
Well, yeah, I just make a point about Saylor. You know, the thing with him is, you know, he's not to be respected because he's got a lot of money. There are a lot of people with a lot of money and a lot more money than him that have stupid opinions. And there are people online on Twitter with anon accounts that have memes that are more truthful than some things that multi-billionaires have ever said, right? So, I mean, you know, just because he has more money, I want to make clear that the unique thing about him is not that he's got a lot of money and he bought Bitcoin. That's not what's unique. What makes him unique is that he proved the game theory out, right? You know, the first rant I gave, you know, in this very discussion today, you know, some people would probably comment and say, oh, that's absurd. A country would never print legal tender. But that's what Saylor's doing. And most people don't understand that. They think, oh, Saylor good because Saylor have many dollars and he buy Bitcoin. Like, that's a very simplistic view of what's actually going on here. What Saylor's doing is he is transitioning the fiat monetary premium of his stock into Bitcoin monetary premium for his stock. He is debasing his own corporate currency, right? He is the monetary god of the corporate entity that is MicroStrategy, right? And he is intentionally diluting it as fast as possible to accumulate as much Bitcoin as possible, right? I mean, this is literally what I was describing, you know, 10, 15 minutes ago, is that, you know, Saylor did the calculation in his head late 2020. He's like, okay, I'm a billionaire. My two options are leverage my network and contacts and energy in this company to artificially force Bitcoin price down and then stack it on the cheap, or raise as much debt as possible by Bitcoin, you know, take all my money, buy Bitcoin, take all my time, figure out more ways to borrow more money to buy more Bitcoin and liquidate everything I have, including my own company stock, and do it under my shareholders to buy as much Bitcoin as possible. So I want to make that very clear that there are multiple people in Bitcoin that are billionaires, right? You have Michael Saylor, obviously. You have the Winklevoss twins, obviously. I believe Tim Cook has said that he's bought Bitcoin. You know, there's a handful of other billionaires who have bought some Bitcoin or a lot of Bitcoin. Obviously, Elon Musk is probably the most famous of them all, who bought a significant amount of Bitcoin. I think he still owns Bitcoin. I don't know about how much, but, you know, probably less than what people think. You know, but my point is that, you know, that I would make clear that's what's special about Saylor. You know, it's not even that he goes out on the podcast. Obviously, yes, he's got a lot of money, so he's important in that sense. And yes, he goes on a lot of discussions and a big advocate, so that's important too. But by far the most important is not that Saylor's rich, it's that Saylor proved the game theory. He saw the two options and he chose print into base and dilute my fiat premium, convert it to Bitcoin premium. It's better for me and it's better for my shareholders. And countries eventually will realize that with their own currencies, right? That we call, you know, political currencies, not corporate paper, right? But so anyway, I mean, you know, maybe we see that. I doubt it though, but when that happens, it's going to be dramatic, right? I mean, it's just, it has to, the math is pretty straightforward there. So yeah, there'll be many billionaires in Bitcoin. There are some now. I've met, I believe, a few of them, you know, but I mean, ultimately that doesn't matter, right? They could lose it, right? Alex Jones had 10,000 Bitcoin worth $50,000 when they were $5 a piece and he lost it all. Alex Jones could have easily been a Bitcoin billionaire, but he wasn't, because he lost his Bitcoin. He lost it, right? And that's why self-custody is so important. You know, Brandon, you know, I talk about that all the time. But my point there is that there are perhaps many other billionaires in Bitcoin that we don't even know about because they bought thousands of Bitcoin a decade ago. And we just don't know. Obviously, that number is probably limited in the dozens or so, but they might be out there. And you mentioned Satoshi. I mean, maybe Satoshi is still out there. I have the suspicion Satoshi's dead with my own personal reasonings. But you know, I mean, you know, so maybe there's 50 Bitcoin billionaires right now, meaning people that own $1 billion worth of Bitcoin. Maybe there's 50, maybe there's a couple hundred, but I don't think it's thousands. And you know, I think in the coming years and decades, we're going to see more and more decide to take that transition.
Yeah, 100%. And then we mentioned Bukele too, so I kind of want to get into how you see the development of Bitcoin or countries holding Bitcoin, because you know, I think the secret sauce to a lot of this is the mining aspect of it, where, you know, obviously the volcano bonds and kind of mining with the volcano has been a topic of El Salvador, but I don't think that they're necessarily doing that just yet. But I mean, you got to think, every single country has its own renewable source of energy, theoretically, right? Whether it's, you know, rivers, creeks, what have you, sunlight. So you could essentially turn that into Bitcoin, which then, you know, you can kind of get rid of taxes in a sense by reusing that renewable energy. And then you just kind of have this never ending cycle, right? Where it's utilizing the renewable energy to mine Bitcoin. And then you got on this Bitcoin standard. So that's, I guess, a long-winded answer to say, like, how do you kind of see it playing out? Do you see, I guess, that as the greener pasture, or do you see some other way that we get to countries kind of developing a Bitcoin standard?
Well, I don't think taxes are going away anytime soon, even if everything else you said is true. But yeah, I mean, I think renewable energies are very important, right? Obviously, you have a spectrum. On one end of the spectrum, you have the people that are the climate alarmists that say there's too many people on the planet, that we're all going to die, we're all going to starve, energy's bad, we got to use less energy, we got to go 100% renewable now. And of course, on the other end of the spectrum, you have the people, largely as a reaction to that, that say, no, fossil fuel is great, fossil fuel is moral, that renewables are, you know, evil, they are inefficient. And obviously, I think the accurate answer, you know, to both of those arguments is we should want what is maximally flourishing for as many humans as possible, as well as the planet, right? And sometimes that is fossil fuels. Sometimes that is natural gas. Sometimes that is wood. Sometimes that is oil. You know, and you know, the climate alarmists would like to deny that, but that is just true, especially for the world's poorest, right? And in irony, it's probably better for the planet too. It is probably worse to have the bottom, let's say, 3 billion people on the economic ladder on the planet relying on intermittent renewable energy, because you know, when the renewable energies aren't working, when it's cloudy outside or when the wind stops blowing, you know, what are they going to do? They're going to go out in the forest, cut down trees, burn it all down, right? Because they need to live, right? It's not a moral thing to them. It's just they have to live. It's more moral to them to go out there and make the lemurs go extinct than for them to let their children starve, right? I mean, it's you know, it's not that these are evil people that hate the planet. It's just, you know, it's a very obvious thing. You would do it too if you're in their circumstance. So obviously that's wrong. But obviously, you know, the people that say we're going to stay on fossil fuel forever, they're also wrong, right? And we are going to have more renewables. And, you know, to your point, I think the energy sector is going to be just as large of a catalyst for accelerating Bitcoin usage and adoption as the financial sector, right? Because the thing with the energy sector is that we need renewable energies, right? Like we cannot service the energy demands of the future on today's energy sources. So we need more renewables. We need more nuclear. Definitely, we need more wind, we need more solar. And the single most efficient technology we have at stabilizing grids to maximize efficiency with those often inefficient and often, you know, probably a better word is intermittent sources of renewable energy. I mean, you know, it is Bitcoin mining, right? We saw this with the eclipse. I mean, you know, if everyone watching this, you know, perhaps for those not in America, just to give some context, in the United States, there was the quote unquote Great American Eclipse back on April 8th, you know, and you know, even the eclipse, we saw Bitcoin mining stabilizing the grid. We saw that in Texas. We saw that in some other more isolated places around the United States. But Bitcoin mining is so efficient at stabilizing electric grids that it can stabilize the grid during, you know, a 3.5 minute eclipse, right? Like, we just can't do that with gas. We can't do that with wind. We can't do that with any other energy source, right? And Bitcoin does that. I mean, that's how dramatically almost futuristic Bitcoin mining is, just by, you know, sheer incentives, right? Like, there's no other industry on the planet greening, you know, becoming more, let's say, carbon efficient as Bitcoin mining, right? Bitcoin mining is going to be carbon negative by sometime between late 2020s. Daniel Batten, I think, said 2028 recently, and you know, I think he's got a few massive projects going on I've seen on Twitter. You know, I was in El Salvador a few days before the eclipse I was mentioning, and you know, I mean, there's about the volcano projects and all that going on there. Obviously, ground's not broken. Obviously, it's many years and decades away, but the innovations a decade away from now are going to be what changed the world a century from now, right? So, I definitely think that, you know, again, this gets back to the game theory. If I am a monetary god or of a given political jurisdiction, I got a currency, like, well, why wouldn't I fund the acceleration of renewable energies with money I can print out of thin air? And then those renewable energies can basically create Bitcoin, you know, out of thin air if I'm, you know, pulling energy out of the wind, out of thin air, right? I mean, more or less, right? If I just print fiat money in existence when it still nonsensically has a fiat premium, turn it into renewable energy that can extract the natural wealth of my country and my people without harming them or killing them. You know, and I can turn the net excess proceeds of that in off-peak hours into Bitcoin. I mean, that, you know, like, that's a little more indirect, and that is probably a longer time horizon and less desperation than the examples we've been talking about before. But really, that's an even better scenario, right? Don't print the money to buy Bitcoin and, you know, freak people out. Print money to accelerate renewable energy projects, and then use that to create more Bitcoin, and not even renewable energy, but oil or gas or whatever it is, right? So, I think it's definitely important. You know, I think that is a very long ways away, and I think it's gonna be very slow. You know, but all forms of energy have trade-offs. Nuclear energy has trade-offs. Wind energy has trade-offs. Gas has trade-offs. You know, petroleum, natural gas, coal. You know, all these things have trade-offs. But we should assume that we're going to continue to innovate towards things with better sets of trade-offs, right? And I think that's what the alarmists miss, is the alarmists pretend like wind energy has no negative trade-offs and coal and oil only have negative trade-offs, right? I mean, it's nonsensical, right? The objective thing is to acknowledge positive and negative trade-offs and then realize that, oh, yes, Bitcoin uses energy. That's, you could argue, a negative trade-off. I don't think it is. But even if you argued that, you could say, oh, but it incentivizes the adoption of renewable energy and makes renewable energy projects profitable years in advance. It helps people in remote regions have access to cheap hydropower, you know, both helping the people and the local environment because it reduces the number of trees cut. You know, and that's not just a narrative. That's real. I was in Guatemala, you know, back in February this year, and that's literally what's happening, right? You know, there are people there, you know, granted, in very, very, very small operations, you know, what some people would laugh at, but it's a really big deal. There are people there in Guatemala that will take the vegetable oil from a local business. So instead of the local business having to take the vegetable oil from their restaurants, putting it on a truck, having the truck drive 14 hours to the main city, where there it could be possibly responsibly, you know, quote unquote processed, aka released in the atmosphere, you know, the restaurant owner either has that option or dump it in the lake, right? And so, you know, these Bitcoin miners, they go around to these restaurants, they acquire the oil from them at no cost, right? I mean, the restaurant's happy because they'd either have to pay a negative cost to ship it out to the city to pump it in the atmosphere, or for free dump it in the lake. But now this weird Bitcoiner will come over to you, take your vegetable oil and burn it in a Bitcoin miner. You know, obviously it goes in the atmosphere, but it would have anyway. And in the process, it means that the business owner saves some money. Maybe that That means that they, you know, get to have a more prosperous life, or, you know, think longer term. And ultimately, that's how we care about the environment. We think longer term, you know. So the Bitcoin miner benefits because now they've got free electricity that they didn't have before from the vegetable oil. Restaurant owner benefits, you know, that's less oil, you know, obviously the oil has its exhaust go into the atmosphere either way, but it doesn't have to take a 14-hour truck drive there, right? And so unfortunately, a lot of people look at Bitcoin and say, oh, it uses energy, but they don't consider all of the factors that, you know, even if Bitcoin still has pollution, quote unquote, you know, it's not necessarily entirely a bad thing. And there's so many possible applications of this, right? Whether it's the vegetable oil, whether it's methane flaring, whether it's, you know, whether it's landfills, whether it's whether it's carbon or carbon capture potentially, and eventually once it becomes profitable, which it's not, wind, nuclear, hydro, everything I've already mentioned, right? But, you know, perhaps the point to really solidify this is that according to, you know, the UN and according to all the three-letter agencies that run the world, right, what is their number one concern? And it is justified, right? Methane, right? That is the number one concern, right? You know, I know there are people that would say it's not a problem, but, you know, it is, right? I would agree probably with you that, you know, famine and nuclear war and other things are probably higher, much higher concerns than methane. But, you know, I mean, you know, we are releasing a significant amount of methane into the environment. That is a fact. And, you know, according to these institutions and the research seems to be pretty clear, methane is far worse on the environment than carbon. And, you know, even if it doesn't have the apocalyptic negative consequences that some people would like to fearmonger others into thinking it has, it still has significant negative consequences. And, you know, therefore, we should find every way possible to mitigate that if we could, right? And so if methane is the number one negative contributing factor to, you know, pollutants in the atmosphere around the planet, what is the number one contributor of methane? Well, the number one contributor is landfills. Okay, and by those same studies and individuals and reports, what is the number one way to convert very toxic or very destructive methane into significantly less destructive CO2 in these number one contributing factors, landfills? Bitcoin. They say that number one is Bitcoin, number two is solar panels, right? So Bitcoin literally by, you know, the climate, who many also I would probably call climate alarmists, not all of them, but, you know, by their own admission, the number one problem is methane. The number one contributor are the landfills. And the number one solution to that is very possibly Bitcoin mining. Right now, tied to solar panels, within 5 years, it'll be significantly better, right? And so anyway, my rambling point is that, you know, I think actually if we strip the politics away from the energy question, the climate question, the pollution question, and the humanitarian question, we realize that all of this is the same answer. We want as much flourishing as possible for as many human beings as possible. And ideally, we would like to preserve as much of the natural world as possible and, you know, protect it, right? I mean, that is the ultimate goal, right? And if you approach it from that first principles mindset, you realize sometimes we need older forms of energy, like wood or natural gas or whatever. Sometimes we need newer forms of energy. We are increasingly going to want newer forms of energy because they have significantly less negative externalities. And the technology, in many ways, it's going to help us bridge from the old energy sources to the new energy sources is Bitcoin mining, because it helps stabilize the negative trade-off of the new energy sources, which is that they're not as immediate as turning on a coal plant. So anyway, I kind of went on a side point there to your question. But yeah, I definitely think that, you know, a lot of the critics of the volcano bonds of El Salvador and similar projects, you know, I think they're being critical right now because they see no progress. And to be fair, there is essentially zero progress on the volcano bond front as of yet, right? Obviously, you know, there is progress, but it's very, very minimal. But I mean, you know, there are other places where these exact same kinds of ideas are being implemented. There is significant progress. And, you know, just because it hasn't manifested yet in El Salvador does not mean it's not going to be extremely true in the future and perhaps sooner than what people expect.
No, 100%. Yeah. I mean, I think like the energy aspect of things is really interesting. And I think that that's going to see a big flip on its head, and a big reason why is Bitcoin. But, you know, we kind of talked about the ETFs a little bit earlier in traditional finance, but we're going to see a lot of normies and new people kind of come into this cycle. We've already mentioned a few, maybe Bitcoin billionaires, maybe they're listening to this show. Maybe they're not, I don't know. but we are going to have a lot of people potentially, you know, coming in and not really knowing how to hold their own keys. And maybe they're a little tentative to get into these ETFs because they've heard of some things, right? They've heard of the FTX crashes. So I want to get into the collaborative custody model and like what's going on at the Bitcoin Advisor. Obviously, we're two coworkers there. So let's hear from your mouth here. Why do you think it's so important to kind of, you know, I guess, practice this collaborative custody model? And do you see this as kind of like the future for maybe some potential savings accounts or, you know, of maybe not savings accounts, but of like a stash that you're putting away for a long period of time or for your kids or what have you?
Yeah, I appreciate the question. So yes, obviously, make it clear, I was the first Bitcoin Advisor team member in the United States. Bitcoin Advisor has been providing collateral custody multi-sig services for people since 2016. Peter Dunworth and Andy Pattinson are the two prominent members founders of Bitcoin Advisor. Obviously, built some out of Australia. So, you know, I am biased in what I'm about to say. But before I talk about that, Brandon, I'd like to address the problem, right? Because hopefully this will pique people's interest, right? What is the problem you're talking about, Brandon? Right. The problem is that you have certain trade-offs. Everything in life's trade-offs, right? I was just talking about that with energy, right? Coal's got trade-offs, wind's got trade-offs, hydro's got trade-offs, right? I mean, you know, it's naive to think that one solution is the solution, right? Oh, hydro is beautiful. Well, yeah, but now you've just messed up the fish populations, right? Oh, wind is perfect. Well, yeah, but you're killing endangered birds, you're killing hawks, and it takes a massive amount of carbon and rare earth minerals to get to the wind turbine in the first place. Oh, well, coal's perfect. No, it's not, right? I mean, 6 million people a year die from pollution of petrol and coal, right? So everything's got trade-offs, right? And the same thing is true with Bitcoin custody, right? So to break it down, what is the problem that needs to be solved here? If you're going to buy Bitcoin, and you're watching this, and you're going to buy Bitcoin, you're learning what's the best way to buy Bitcoin, okay? You're going to buy Bitcoin through an exchange, most probably, or you're going to buy in an ETF, right? Now, you have basically three options. Option one is to accept counterparty risk, right? Option two is to accept yourself as a single point of failure. And option three is to have a collateral custody model where there is zero single point of failure. So let's talk about counterparty risk. This is when you own Bitcoin via MicroStrategy shares. This is when you own Bitcoin via the ETF. This is when you own Bitcoin on an exchange. You got two Bitcoins sitting on your Coinbase account. You got half a Bitcoin sitting on River. You got 3.7 Bitcoin sitting in Swan. You got Bitcoin on here or there, wherever. It doesn't matter. It's all counterparty risk. Your Bitcoin is not safe in Swan exchange. Your Bitcoin is not safe on Coinbase exchange. Your Bitcoin is not safe in an ETF. It's not safe on any of these platforms. Okay, some of these platforms I really like and admire. Others I don't. But at the end of the day, it's still the same fundamental risk. Counterparty risk. If the United States government wanted to do what we were describing earlier, Brandon, of deciding we want Bitcoin out, what are they going to do? Are they going to come after 100,000 people, each with one Bitcoin in self-custody? Or are they going to pick up the phone and call Coinbase? And as you said, Brandon, collect the Bitcoin of 9 of the 11 ETFs, right? What are they going to do? Obviously, they're going to go after the ETFs, right? And if you think I'm fear-mongering, the United States did this in 1933 with gold. The United States confiscated all the gold. They gave the U.S. dollar equivalent of the gold to the gold holders. And then the price of gold quadrupled the following year, and the United States marked it up on the balance sheet, right? America's got this much debt, and we've got this much equity. That's our problem. America does not have a debt problem, or debt problem. We have a debt-to-equity problem, or debt-to-GDP problem. What happens when any government, especially in particular the American government, what happens when any government realizes, let's just add a little bit more debt and use that debt, like I'm saying, to buy more Bitcoin, and that will accelerate our, you know, that will accelerate our positive side of the balance sheet and thus assist us, right? And that's a question people are going to have to consider. What if the United States of America and other countries, I'm just using America in this example because it's the ETFs what we're talking about, what if their debt is not going to collapse? What if instead they print more money to buy the Bitcoin to then plug the hole, just like they did with gold? And so my point is that counterparty risk, if you're in Bitcoin, should never be tolerated, especially with a significant portion or the entirety of your stack. If you own Bitcoin in an ETF, if you own Bitcoin in an exchange, if you own Bitcoin in any counterparty risk, you do not own Bitcoin. You don't understand what you own. You are jumping the Titanic into the lifeboat and like I described before, tying You know, you're somehow tying the success of the lifeboat to the Titanic. You're taking the risk of jumping into the lifeboat, of breaking your leg, and you have the risk of the Titanic. It is better for you to stay in dollars than for you to buy Bitcoin and throw it in the ETF, right? I mean, you know, even if that's not literally true in terms of price action, I do believe on a risk-adjusted basis, it is very true. If you are buying Bitcoin and accept counterparty risk, you do not understand this, and you're being a hypocrite to yourself, and I'm not trying to be rude or needlessly spur controversy. I'm just stating what I believe is fact. You know, it's nonsensical, right? It's like owning gold, but not owning gold, owning a piece of paper to the gold, right? It's like buying fire insurance on the house, but also setting, tearing down the house so there's no more house to burn, right? It's like you're paying an expense. You're accepting more risk with no benefit, right? And so that's the first option. Accept counterparty risk for Bitcoin. I do not believe that is logical, right? And people can call me a fearmonger now, but I was saying the same thing with FTX. I never had a single dollar of Bitcoin in FTX. I never, I didn't lose any money in the FTX collapse. It's because I understood this. People called me crazy. FTX is the most regulated exchange by the SEC in the world. FTX is the second largest exchange. Sam Bankman-Fried's a genius. He's a philanthropist. Don't you love him? He's so cute, right? No, they were not just fraudulent. They were completely fraudulent. The SEC completely screwed it up. Why do you trust the same three-letter agency that was managing FTX to manage the ETF? FTX, ETF, SEC, they're all three-letter names, all controlled by human beings. It's better to just stick with Bitcoin, right? So I hopefully I've hammered that point home. The first option with Bitcoin custody is counterparty risk. Do not tolerate it. You got two options left. Your first option of the acceptable options is to take self-custody, meaning own the Bitcoin yourself, but to where you become a single point of failure. The other option is to take self-custody yourself, but have multiple points of failure so that there's no single point of failure, right? So the single point of failure option means you take self-custody and you write down your seed phrase and you stuff it under your mattress. You take self-custody, you have it all in a ledger or on a Trezor or whatever. You write down the seed phrase and you put the seed phrase in your safety, quote unquote, safety deposit box at your bank, right? You take your seed phrase and you memorize it, right? You take your seed phrase and you give it to your mom. You take your seed phrase, you give it to your kid. You take your seed phrase, you cut it up in three pieces, you spread it around, you know, in different locations, right? Of those possible scenarios I just listed, some of them I would argue are stupid. Others are understandable why people would do them. Never cut your seed phrase into multiple segments and spread it around. You are getting all of the risks and no benefits, right? You're no longer having one single point of failure. You now have three single points of failure. If you lose one part of that seed phrase, your Bitcoin is essentially gone, right? To give some context, how many different potential seed phrases are there with a 12-word seed phrase? Well, there are 7.5 sextillion, I believe. It's either sextillion or septillion. I think it's sextillion grains of sand on the planet. There's roughly 100 quadrillion different seed phrases for every individual grain of sand. Okay, if you cut up your seed phrase and you divide it around and you think that you're being smart, respectfully, I'm trying to warn you, you're not. If you lose any portion of that seed phrase, the entirety of your Bitcoin is gone. You are not protecting yourself. You are increasing your risk by orders of magnitude for no benefit. You are not achieving zero single point of failure. Okay, let's go with another example. You memorize it. That, I think, is a much more understandable solution. You have your Bitcoin, you memorize your seed phrase, that's great, right? If you die, you die with your keys, right? You know, nobody can take it from you. Only if you die, you lose it. But the problem is, what happens if you have a stroke or have a car accident and you forget? You forget your seed phrase. What happens if you get older, inevitably, and you possibly have dementia? What happens then? What happens if you just forget? We forget things all the time. I mean, you know, what happens, you know, as I was joking about this with someone yesterday, actually, you know, what happens if I'm a hypnotist and in 20 years, I figure out that, hey, I think Brandon, I think he's got a couple Bitcoin. And, you know, I can use my AI bot that I got for 2 cents from some, you know, Nigerian kid. And I can use it to figure out that, oh, Brandon 20 years ago on Twitter was tweeting about how he's going to memorize his seed phrase and he's a sovereign individual, all that. You know, like if I'm a hypnotist, what if I hypnotize you and somehow I get your seed phrase out of you, right? I'm not even really into that. Like, I don't care. I'm just kind of pulling strings here out of thin air. But my point is, if you're memorizing seed phrase, you have to accept you are taking a single point of failure. And for some people, that's okay. They're fine with that. But if I'm memorizing my seed phrase, what happens if I die? What happens if the hypnotist gets to me? You know, what happens if I have that car accident? I lose my memory. What happens, you know, in any scenario where I, you know, screw this up? If I've got a wife, if I've got kids, if I've got a business, if I got my parents, I mean, that is, obviously it's a donation to the network, but I want to support my personal network. I obviously want to support the Bitcoin network, but I'm not willing to support the Bitcoin network at the expense of my personal familial network, right? So then you have the other possible solution. Well, what happens if I give my seed phrase to my mom or to my dad or to my kids or to my cousin or to my Bitcoin buddy, you know, or that I found at the Bitcoin meetup, or my lawyer? I can give my Bitcoin seed phrase to my lawyer. But the problem is, in all of those scenarios, now you've done two things. Number one, you've put yourself at risk because now your family members have potential access to your coins. Even if I trust them with my life, they have that access to it. But the number two, you've increased them as now a single point of failure, right? See, here's the thing is that, you know, I love my mom. I trust her with my life. But, you know, I love her, but she can't remember her email password, right? I don't know if you know, she's here right now. I'm visiting family right now. This week, it's my birthday next week. So, you know, hopefully she's not here to hear me say that. But, you know, I love my mom to death, right? And you know, most people, you know, love their family to death. They love their kids, their parents, whomever. But, like, I don't trust my mom with her Facebook password. Why am I going to trust my seed phrase? What happens? Like, is she a reliable backup for me? No. If I lose it, I call her up and say, hey, mom, I'm out of state. I lost my seed phrase. You know, you have that backup, right? Oh, I don't know. Blah, blah, blah. It's like, you know, your family members, even if you love them to death and you trust them with your life, you don't trust them, you know, with those certain passwords. But let's say I did. Let's say I did. Let's say my mom is excellent at keeping those passwords, you know, and she never loses it. But now the problem is, let's say theoretically I have, you know, 10 Bitcoin, right? And let's say Bitcoin goes to $1 million. Now I've got $10 million of Bitcoin. You know, my name is out there. My face is out there. Even if it wasn't, people could find me. You know, what happens is now I've put a $10 million bounty on my mom's head, essentially. That might be a little dramatic, put that bluntly, but essentially that's what it is. And I don't want to do that to my family. And respectfully to those listening that have done this, I'm not trying to shame anybody, but I don't think most Bitcoiners are seriously prepared for the potential upside of Bitcoin. You might you might say, I've got my seed phrase memorized. You might say, I'm teaching my kids about Bitcoin. You know, when I pass, they're going to get my seed phrase. It's all going to be great. That's wonderful. But does your wife actually have the interest and desire to maintain the security of Bitcoin, of not only of Bitcoin seed phrases, but make sure she understands all the nuance of every hardware wallet on the market? Make sure she understands how to do UTXO management properly and definitely. Make sure to have the configuration files set up if you need that, to make sure to run a note. Like do your family members actually have the technical knowledge to do that and care enough to continue doing that ongoing for their life? And even if they do those things, do you really want your kid to have, you know, $500,000, $5 million, $18 million, or $100 million of Bitcoin, you know, on their head as a single point of failure? You know, there's the potential, obviously, of a $5 wrench attack. You know, and that's perhaps the most fear-mongering answer. But the far more likely scenario is a SIM card swap, right? I had to switch my SIM card recently for an unrelated thing. I was not SIM card swapped, but, you know, I just doubled down my security a bit. But I've had clients that get SIM card swapped. I lots of people online get SIM card swapped all the time, right? I mean, you know, far more likely than the violent analog $5 wrench attack, you know, is the non-violent digital attack, right? Is, you know, the person trying to come after you or your loved ones via email, phishing attacks, SIM card swaps, you know, just constant calls on your phone all the time trying to get your Bitcoin, right? Scams, right? All of these things are single points of failure. And if your family members do not have the ability to steward the Bitcoin in the face of all those things, those are serious problems. So the points I'm making with these single points of failure, and there are additional ones too. I mean, we didn't even talk about UTXO management. I'm not even talking about the potential risk of, you know, some sort of ledger leak or the signing device that you create your seed phrase with being corrupted. I mean, there's that possibility too. However, I don't think it's the largest one. Also, there's the question of tax. Can you own Bitcoin in your retirement account with a single sig? No. Can you have self-custody Bitcoin in your Roth IRA? No. In a Roth IRA, your two options are collateral custody or accepting counterparty risk. So single points of failure inherently are not tolerable in these kinds of retirement products because the government can't verify that you're obeying the letter of the law with your taxable situation. And so then we get to this third possibility for Bitcoin custody. That is collateral custody with your Bitcoin. And that's only possibly via multi-sig, right? Not a self-directed multi-sig. You don't fix the problem with self-directed multi-sig. It's probably one of the best options if you're still going to have a single point of failure, but that's only because it's the closest to collateral custody multi-sig. So collateral custody multi-sig, what are the benefits? What are the downsides? Collateral custody multi-sig, the main benefit is you achieve zero single point of failure. You don't have to deal with a dozen problems anymore. all of those problems, 6102 attack, violent $5 rent attack, entrusting your family members, UTXO management, the hard device being a single point of failure, having your seed phrase, you're no longer dealing with a dozen different single points of failure. By having one setup that removes single points of failure, you've solved all those problems simultaneously, instantly more peace of mind, right? So that is the main value add, right? Meaning it's your Bitcoin is have lower risk. And also, of course, really, that's the tangible benefit I just said. There's an intangible benefit too. The intangible benefit is that it justifies buying more Bitcoin, right? If the biggest risk to your Bitcoin is that you lose it. It's not Bitcoin price volatility. It's that you lose it. And if you remove that fundamental risk, that fundamental largest risk to your Bitcoin stack by, let's say, an order of magnitude, if you successfully do that, well, of course, it justifies you having a higher allocation of Bitcoin. Like so many of my clients, the Bitcoin advisor and other people I've talked to, actually a few days ago, I was on a call with my first client ever. He's in his late 30s, and he bought about 50% more Bitcoin after setting us up because he had the emotional stamina to do it and because he could finally justify it, right? The fastest way to convince your loved one, to convince your mom, to convince your wife, to convince your kid to buy Bitcoin is to show them the way to buy it safely, securely, where they will never lose it, right? And so by decreasing your self-custody risk in owning Bitcoin, it is the single fastest and most efficient way at which you can achieve peace of mind, which ultimately that's the whole point of Bitcoin, but also increase your SAT stack. And also not only that directly for you, but it's the fastest way to help your loved ones. You know, your family members, your coworkers, they may not understand Bitcoin. They may not, want to do it. But if they can have their hand held through a proper custody process where they're not going to get rugged by an ETF and where they can actually hold their own keys and be sovereign with their coins, but where still they're not going to, send all their Bitcoin away to some scammer giving them a QR code saying, give me one Bitcoin, I'll send you two back, right? Like, it is the ideal scenario for orange pilling those loved ones and family members so they adopt Bitcoin so they understand Bitcoin, right? So for you, it's the way to lower your peace of mind, or to increase your peace of mind by lowering your risk. It's the fastest way to buy more Bitcoin. It's the fastest way to orange pill your family members. Now, what is the trade-off? The trade-off with it is that you have to, it's a little more complicated of a setup. And obviously, typically, you're going to pay somebody a fee to be part of it. If they're going to be technically knowledgeable, if they're going to provide a service, not just a product, you got to pay a fee, right? You got to pay a small tangible fee in order to sustain that vault over time with an ongoing costs associated with the service. But I would argue that the benefits vastly outweigh the downsides. Yeah, maybe you're paying, $10,000 a year for this vault, but if the vault is giving you $20,000 worth of peace of mind, it's freeing up hundreds of hours of your time every single year. It's doubled your Bitcoin stack. It's helped orange pill other people in your network. This is the beautiful thing is that, and this gets to Bitcoin Advisor. Bitcoin Advisor has been providing this since 2016, right? One more point is the Roth IRA example or the retirement account example, right? Unfortunately, April 15th just passed, but I was making this very clear for a long period of time and people ignored me, Brandon. People ignored me. They said, oh, you're talking about multi-sig too much. You're talking about counterparty risk, blah, blah, blah. But then finally it came down to the wire and a bunch of people realized at the last minute, oh my goodness, I can own self-custody Bitcoin in my retirement account. In my Roth IRA, my 401k, my Supermanaged Superfund, in my pension, I can have a trust. I can do this with Bitcoin in self-custody? I didn't know that. Well, people, don't think. They just look at collateral custody and they see the downside. Oh, it's expensive. It's complicated. I don't understand it. It's scary. But they don't consider, yes, you're paying a fee and you're investing a little bit of time now to get that set up. But if you can do that in a tax advantage account where the Bitcoin grows tax-free, that's a massive implication. If you buy one Bitcoin in your Roth IRA and you have it in a cloud custody multi-sig, and that Bitcoin grows tax-free up by a factor of 100, it doesn't matter if you paid a few percent worth of the Bitcoin in fees, because now you've stacked way more Bitcoin than you possibly could have, because otherwise you'd have had to give so much over in taxes to the government eventually when you spend it, move it, or transfer it somewhere else in the world, right? So my point is that, all of these things have downsides. Counterparty risk has downsides. Single points of failure and single sig solutions have downsides. Collateral custody risk has downsides. But ultimately, my encouragement is for people to learn about all the upsides and downsides and all these things, because it's going to be really important. Eventually, it's going to hit the fan and people are going to realize, oh my gosh, my two options are do it on my own and invest 1,000 hours to learn how to do it on my own. And even if you do it on your own, inherently, that means you're not achieving lack of single point of failure, because on your own implies single point of failure. So number one, I can do it on my own, still not achieve single point of failure. And, you know, it takes hundreds and probably more like 1,000 hours of work, maybe even more if I'm not the most technically advanced person. Option two is hire somebody to do it. But my concern is that if and when Bitcoin does begin to radically appreciate in price, what happens is that you have no more time and it's 10 times more expensive to have somebody help you do it. And that's why I'm encouraging people to do it now, right? If you own Bitcoin ETF, get out now when you still can. If you don't yet own Bitcoin in your retirement account, your 401k, Roth IRA, whatever, please consider doing it now. If you own 100% of your Bitcoin in single sig solutions and you think you'll always be that way, please consider the possibility that when Bitcoin goes up by a factor of 50, you're probably going to be so stressed by the amount of Bitcoin that you have that you're going to want 20% of it in collateral custody multisig. So that way, even if you die, even if you're hit by a bus, even if you forget your seed phrase or someone comes after you, you know you're going to be okay and that your kids are going to get it, right? You know, and I think that is the primary problem people in Bitcoin have, is they're not too bullish. Yeah, I think the majority of people, Brandon, in Bitcoin today are like Alex Jones. And they have their Bitcoin and they think that they're smart and they think that it's going to be great, but they're not bullish enough. Okay. You know, Alex Jones, we got to keep this in mind. Alex Jones only had $50,000 worth of Bitcoin and it went to $1 billion and he lost it. Right. Alex Jones's problem was not that, oh, I don't own enough Bitcoin. It was not, oh, I timed the cycle wrong. It was not, oh, what about the halving? It was not any of those things. Alex Jones's problem was that he was not bullish enough and he didn't understand what he owned, right? And that's my encouragement for people listening, is that if you've not yet owned Bitcoin, this is why I put out all kinds of free resources on my Twitter and especially my YouTube about where to buy Bitcoin, how to do it safely, even if it's your first $100. But then just as importantly, I try to lecture people and pound into their heads, take your self-custody seriously. Do not accept counterparty risk. And I highly encourage you avoid having single points of failure, because I don't think most Bitcoiners realize the importance of what I'm saying. And that's not saying that I'm, you know, any smarter than anyone else I'm talking to. That's just saying I've been in that position before, right? I've gone through these mental questions before in my mind. I've considered all of the custody options and all the custody possibilities. And this is the conclusion I keep arriving to. Millions of people are going to want this, but the supply of people available to provide this precise service is going to be relatively scarce in comparison to the demand. The Bitcoin Advisor has been providing this service since 2016. Nobody else yet has been able to compete with us, right? We've not had a single client ever lose a single Satoshi, hundreds of millions of dollars in the various Bitcoin vaults, the company. You know, we have many, many very wealthy Bitcoiners in our company and many, many just average plebs, right? But unfortunately, the reality is that even if the Bitcoin Advisor increases in its ability to service clients by a factor of 20 this cycle, if the demand for the service increases by a factor of 100, we get 5 times more scarce. And I just don't think people realize that this is a radically important thing. You know, everything in life is a trade-off. And if you want to benefit from being in Bitcoin this early, when you could still afford whole UTXOs, the trade-off for you is that you got to be extremely paranoid with your Bitcoin. And most people watching this are not paranoid enough with their Bitcoin because they are not bullish enough.
There you go, man. I love it. Well, you've been very generous with your time here. So why don't you tell everybody where they can find you and where they can find out more about the Bitcoin Advisor and all the other stuff you got going on?
Yeah, well, I encourage everyone to go to my YouTube page as well as my Twitter. On those, I have what I'm calling a little 5-step accelerator. Basically, it's a free PDF for people to read through and have the walkthrough process of where do I buy Bitcoin, where do I have it safely. It is oriented to people brand new to Bitcoin, but it does have the multi-sig and the components towards the end of that. Also, they can find me on YouTube, any of my videos in the comments description, anywhere on my Twitter. They can find where they can contact me and the team at the Bitcoin Advisor. They can get free consultations there. I can send over a 5-hour free multi-sig educational course or video series, is probably a better word than course. That's completely free, and that's 5 hours of video. With me, Andy, and Peter talking about, you know, all the different possible ways to store Bitcoin. There's also a 38-page checklist that Bitcoin Advisor provides for the self-custody musts. Even if you do it on your own, even if you do it on your own for free and you don't want to pay somebody, you know, it's still really useful services. So yeah, people can find me, just my name. The name's on the screen right here, if I can point to it. There you go. Luke Broyles, just search that on YouTube. or Twitter, eventually LinkedIn and Instagram soon, hopefully I'm getting on. But one way or the other, they can follow me there for more content. I provide lots of free content. And when they get ready and they realize that they need to take their self-custody seriously and consider at least a portion of their Bitcoin in multi-sig collateral custody, I'll be here to help. And hopefully they do it before the next wave of adoption really kicks things into gear. So Brandon, thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, of course, I love
what you're doing. Yeah.
Thanks. I appreciate that. Yeah. And I'll put all that in the show notes as well. So if you want to check out Luke's stuff, definitely do that. And yeah, Luke, thanks so much, brother.
Thank you.